The rise of an American Jewish intelligentsia began with the influx of Jewish immigrants who crowded into New York at the turn of the 19th century, bringing many young people with ambitions of becoming writers and creative thinkers, as was natural for a people that ascribed the highest value to intellectual activity. The newspaper was itself a hybrid form of information and entertainment, commerce and ideology, persuasion and accommodation, individual expression for the mass market. The Yiddish newspaper had further to negotiate between the European past and the American present, between staying Jewish and becoming American. This is, as I explained last time, this is a kind of a prequel to the other series that I did on the New York intellectuals, who were the later New York intellectuals. After doing that series, I realized that I would rather go back to an earlier, to the beginnings of what one could call an American Jewish intelligentsia. And some of these, of course, are Yiddish writers, but I am doing this series on intellectuals. So even though I am speaking about a poet today and a poet next time, I have chosen to speak about poets who are also, I think, thinkers, and much of whose poetry is ideational. And so I would say that they fit in this series. Well, Jacob Glotstein is one of the great poets of the 20th century. In the introductory lecture to this series, I said that it might seem strange that poetry rather than prose should have been the favorite medium of Yiddish literature in America, unless we realize that fiction needs a strong social basis that poetry can do without. Newcomers to a country lack the kind of stable environment that you need, especially for long fiction. The poet, by contrast, can express his own thoughts and feelings, explore her private experience, address the surroundings from a subjective, personal perspective. So literature in every form flourished among the Yiddish immigrants to America. But until they became more settled, it was poetry that dominated the literary cafes. So I will begin here with the opening poem of Glotstein's first book of poetry, a frankly autobiographical poem entitled 1919, which is the year it was written. No trace left these days of Yankel, Reb Isaac's son, only a tiny round particle wheeling annoyingly through the streets, thrashing clumsy stumps. The great Lord ringed the whole earth with sky blue and no rescue. From high up, extras fall all over, squashing my soggy head. One with a long tongue splattered my glasses with a permanent splotch of red. Red, red, red. Listen, these days something will burst in my skull and with dull crash burst into flame, leaving behind a small heap of dirty ash. Tiny round particle I'll swir in eternities of ether, swathed in red veils. Well, what you can recognize immediately are the images of explosion, bombardment, and bloodshed that invoke what was happening that year overseas in that last year of the First World War and midpoint of the Civil War in Russia, conflicts that trapped Jewish communities among opposing armies and killed tens of thousands of their inhabitants. Jews referred to this as the Churban, the same term that they used in Yiddish for the destruction of the temples and that they would later use for what English calls the Holocaust and Hebrew calls the Shoah. But the poet in New York is being bombarded by newsboys hawking late-breaking extra editions of the daily newspapers. His experiences are entirely subjective. Born in Lublin, Poland, this Yankel, Reb Isaac's son, who had come to the United States in 1914, feels himself being blown apart by reports of the European catastrophe. The tiny round particle that he refers to is the dot under the Yud, which is the first letter of his name, Yankov, and of the Yiddish word Yid, Jew, and it is the source of the expression Das Pintele Yid, the little dot of the Jew, signifying all that remains of a modern Jew who has shed everything but the tiniest obdurate trace of his Jewishness. So do you understand? I'm translating this, but this is not something that the English poet could possibly render, because it just doesn't exist in English, that tiny dot that he is referring to quite specifically. Nothing else, the poem tells us, survives of the young man who was once called up to the Torah as the son of his father. The remaining amputated parts of his identity whirl, he says, under God's blue sky, an encirclement that allows no escape. The immigrant who came to America to escape Europe's violence has been detonated by the news of that violence, and everything, he says, will thenceforth be colored for him by the red, red, red blood of war and revolution. Now, this opening poem of his first book of poems, 1921, which he called by his name, Yaakov Gladstein, introduces a Jewish immigrant who is very different from our previous subject, Abraham Kahan. Kahan plunged right into the American maelstrom, mostly in English. To be sure, Gladstein, who anglicized his name alternately as Gladstone and Gladstein, also achieved English mastery of a very well-educated American, even as he joined Yiddish literary circles and published Yiddish poems in local newspapers and literary journals. He also read widely in the work of contemporary Anglo-American writers, with special emphasis on James Joyce, who started out as a poet, T.S. Eliot, Walt Whitman, and the Imagists, whose innovations he greatly admired and adapted. But whereas Yiddish was only one option for Kahan, Gladstein stayed exclusively in his Yiddish language. His signature poem that we read here played on idiosyncratic features of his instrument, and this shows us why, as a poet, he would have had to stay within the Yiddish cultural sphere. And that, by the way, was when Yiddish in America was at its demographic peak. New York had come to vie with Vilna and Warsaw as a thriving center of Yiddish creativity, not just of Yiddish speech and of theater and of people living there, but of Yiddish literary creativity, and especially, as I say, of poetry. Now, while he was figuring out how to earn his living, Gladstein had been studying for a law degree at New York University, and there he met Nachum Baruch Minkoff, who had arrived in America with hardly any knowledge of Yiddish. So I think this little incident shows you exactly how attractive Yiddish was. Minkoff had attended Russian schools in Europe and college in America, yet he was so drawn to the Yiddish literary circle that by the time he graduated NYU Law School, he was publishing Yiddish poems and decided that he preferred to earn his living teaching Yiddish. At the point of graduation, when Minkoff decided to leave law for literature, he and Gladstein joined a third poet, Aaron Leolis, to create a new journal around a new idea of poetry. They called their movement In Sich, In the Self, or Introspectivism. And in 1920, they issued a manifesto declaring a bold new form of verse. Their literary manifesto can best be understood against the background of two earlier American Yiddish literary movements, the proletarian poets of the first immigrant wave. And you can tell by the way they were referred to, their verse drew attention to the harsh living and working conditions, and their successors, the Junge, the young, who wanted poetry to transcend realism or to withdraw into more private themes. Now, the introspectivists declared themselves modernist by rejecting the need for regular stanzaic rhyme and rhythm. And they said that they would write only in free verse because one could not adequately express interiority in a fixed form. For us, they declared, everything is personal. And I can read you just this small part of their manifesto. Wars and revolutions, anti-Jewish pogroms and the workers' movement, Protestantism and Buddha, the Yiddish school and the cross, the mayoral elections and a ban on our language, all of these may concern us or not, just as we may be unsettled or not by a blonde woman and by our own unrest. If it does concern us, we write poetry. If it does not, we keep quiet. In either case, we write about ourselves because these things exist only insofar as they are in us, insofar as they are perceived introspectively. So you hear here the very strong influence of psychoanalysis that explores how events are filtered through the individual consciousness. And so these poets seem to be saying, the world is out there, but only to the degree that I absorb it into myself. Now, in this series on intellectuals, I concentrate on Glotzstein from among several dozen excellent poet contemporaries because he was their most fully engaged thinker. A colleague of his commented, why should I say that he was one of the most intelligent among us? He was the most intelligent. From that mind, through a fascinating evolution, a masterful poet would become a sharp-edged critic and an outspoken champion of his people. And also, in a manner not unlike his biblical namesake, Jacob, a stubborn wrestler with God. So after abandoning law and forced to live by other means, Glotzstein found ready employment at the Morgen Journal, a Zionist and conservative-tending daily newspaper whose main competitors were the socialist Vorwärts and the communist Freiheit. While most immigrant Jews in the 1920s would have defined themselves as moderately traditional, Yiddish culture leaned sharply leftward, and Glotzstein suffered the usual fate of non-Marxists who in a progressive environment are routinely dismissed as being reactionary. He was further accused of elitism for his modernism and for the complexities of his writing. Now, were my purpose here to trace Glotzstein's poetry, which it would be a pleasure to do as well, but we would linger then on his second book called Free Verses of 1926, poems pitched to the educated reader on subjects like Chinese theater and complicated love triangles. In one poem, he presents himself as a young sultan on the raucous Jewish street. You know, he, the sultan, in like on the Lower East Side. And in another, he presents himself as Saul, the Bible's first monarch, head and shoulders above the rest, as it says, and simultaneously a reluctant king begging to be relieved of his throne. His third book, Exegidisch, Yiddishteichen, is his most inventively original. But Glotzstein's life and writing took a sharp turn in June 1934, 20 years after his arrival in America, when he was suddenly called back to Lublin, to the bedside of his dying mother. So when he got this summons, left everything behind, and returned to Poland, his work at the Morgen Journal had kept him informed about the mounting threats to the Jews under Hitler, who had recently been appointed Chancellor of Germany, and under Stalin, who was then consolidating his murderous rule in the Soviet Union. In Palestine, the Grand Mufti, al-Husseini, and his gangs were rampaging against the Jews. And in America, too, anti-Semitism was on the rise. Despite the grim summons home, Glotzstein had welcomed the temporary freedom from domestic and financial responsibilities. Yet instead of allowing him contemplative leisure that he had looked forward to on his journey, the Atlantic crossing plunged him deeper into political reality. On July 1st, this is all while he is aboard ship, the ship's daily newscast reports that Hitler, tightening his control over the Nazi Party, had just purged his own stormtroopers, the SA, and murdered their chief. Instantaneously, this news separates Glotzstein and the alarmed Jewish passengers from the Gentiles aboard, who are indifferent to such news. On the second leg of his journey, a trip by train across Western Europe to Poland, he feels the menace of a band of Nazi youth that comes on train bent on intimidating their seatmates. And on arriving in Poland, he is stunned by the contrast between the relative security of New York, even then in the throes of the Great Depression, and the catastrophic helplessness of the Jews he meets in Warsaw and Lublin. We know this because after the death of his mother and his return to New York, Glotzstein began writing a work of autobiographical fiction about his trip that is narrated by Yash, his fictional stand-in. Interwoven with this account of the journey, Yash recalls episodes of his boyhood, his years as an anxious immigrant, and some of the indignities he experienced. In fact, we learn more from this book about Glotzstein's life than we would get to know from any other source. The Yash series was supposed to be divided into three parts: the outbound journey, the stay in Poland, and then the return to New York. The first part, when Yash set out, describes the narrator's encounters with his fellow voyagers and the very dangerous world that they are navigating. Part two, when Yash arrived, is set during a week's stay at the resort town of Nalechov, not far from Lublin. In what feels like suspended time, we are introduced to an entire cast of Polish Jews, anxious hotel keeper and his guests, some of them suffering from arteriosclerosis, vacationers intermingled with the medical patients whom he finds there, a tribe of visitors, 10, you know, the magical number of 10 visitors actually come, including a relative, to ask this American for his advice and to plead with him for help in reaching their relatives and in getting to America. We also meet an historian of Hasidism, and we meet a young counterpart of this historian, a Hasidic boy, a frightening genius who is bursting with ideas that seem to exceed the bounds of any single mind. I mean, it's a fascinating book. On his final day at the resort and final day of the book, Yash takes a day trip to the historic town of Kazimierz, at the center of which, if you've ever been there or ever will be, stands a castle museum of the fabled Queen Esterke. We are here now in the week before Purim, so this is very appropriate. According to local legend, modeled on the Book of Esther and with the same historical basis, this 14th century Jewish young woman, mistress or wife of the Polish king Casimir the Great, persuaded her husband to invite the Jews into his country. Now, this legend, which is beloved, not just of Jews, but it was beloved of the Poles as well. Casimir still circles around that castle museum. This legend represents the liberal side of Poland's integration of the Jews, and that is how the American traveler Yash, both native son and visiting journalist, experiences it, full of love for this rich chapter in Jewish history a chapter that he sees is about to end. The two books of this intended trilogy I edited as the Glotstein Chronicles, and they read like a requiem. This is the book, and it's being reissued by the Yiddish Book Center, so this will keep it in circulation. Now, book three, When Yash Returned, was never completed. On returning to New York, Glotstein had also begun writing a weekly column of political reportage. One could say that he strapped himself to the newsroom's ticker tape in the way that religiously observant Jews put on their phylacteries, their tefillin, to pray. Here are some of the Morgen Journal headlines of 1935. British allow no leniency for immigration to Eretz Israel. Many Jews killed in Nazi concentration camp. Nations warn Italy that attack on Abyssinia will mean world war. Nazi Germany is danger to the entire world, declares Churchill in speech before British Parliament, and so on. Glotstein wrote that these world events engaged in constant swordplay over Jewish heads made him feel like a strategist maneuvering invisible armies in legendary lands. No one has chosen him, but he speaks into a wasteland where one hears only the echo of one's own voice. So, determined to make that voice heard, Glotstein wrote, for example, in October 1935, denouncing the New York press for, quote, publishing liberal editorials about brotherly love, freedom of the press, equality, fraternity, and justice. But when it comes to the Nazis and their inhuman attacks on Jews, the paper forgets its liberalism and becomes as careful as if it were being issued by the State Department. I make no comment. He signaled out our, in quotation marks, New York Times, for burying the news of Polish pogroms on a back page, along with other news of Hitler's crimes. He decried President Roosevelt's lukewarm response to Hitler's actions and the over-civilized and utterly ineffectual interventions of Jewish representatives like Rabbi Stephen Wise, and he came out against the communists. Now, it was not unusual for the Yiddish press to damn right-wing fascism and the failure of liberalisms to confront it. Glotstein was unusual in refusing to accept communism's claim to be the ostensible answer and the only answer to fascism, the only solution to the Great Depression. The Soviet Union's prestige rose even higher in 1935 when Stalin launched his Popular Front, encouraging cooperation with liberals whom he had until then excoriated as class enemies. After that, the international left denounced any aspersion on Stalin or communism as an endorsement of Hitler. Now, Glotstein did not succumb to this moral blackmail. American Jews, he argued, should not be required to support the evils of the left in order to defeat the evil on the right. He urged Jews to resist both the Nazis who intended to destroy them and the Soviet threat to Jewish religion, Zionism, and Jewish immigration to Palestine. As opposed to the Comintern, which is the Communist International, he invented the concept of a Yidenturn, a Jewish international, and he urged this hoped-for body to stand up to both enemy regimes. What drove Glotstein to the breaking point were the Polish pogroms in towns around his native Lublin, violence that the Polish leader, Joseph Piłsudski, had kept in check, erupted then in anti-Jewish attacks after the general's death in May of 1935. It says much for Glotstein, but little for human progress, that his columns on these subjects remain as urgent today as when they were written. Glotstein remained first and foremost a poet, but his verse changed when he became simultaneously a strong political writer. His modernist experimentation now met the challenge of making things plain. In a series of dramatic monologues begun in the mid-1930s, he has the Hasidic master, Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, speaking to his scribe, Nathan of Hanover, about the need to simplify his paradoxical insights without compromising their subtlety. Nathan, lay off thinking today. Have you ever seen such a world, such loveliness every which way? So, channeling the Bratslaver, Glotzstein wanted to simplify complexity. It was no longer a matter of filtering experiences through the individual psyche, but of expressing hard ideas in hard form. Goodnight World is dated April 1938. Goodnight, white world, big stinking world. Not you, but I slam shut the gate. With my long gabardine, my fiery yellow patch, with head erect, and at my sole command, I go back into the ghetto. The word farhak, slam, which he chooses over the milder word farmach, is to close. He says farhak, which means to shut so that you cannot reopen it. That forever shuts off the speaker's appetite for the worldly culture he had once worked so hard to join. Instead of calling on God, as Jews traditionally did, pour out your wrath on the nations that know you not, the poet does it for them. Wipe off all markings of apostasy. I roll my body in your grime. Glory, glory, glory to you, crippled Jewish life. I cast out all your unclean cultures, world. Though all has been laid waste, I burrow in your dust, sorrowing Jewish life. Swinish German, hostile Polak, thievish Amalekite, land of swill and guzzle, slobbering democracy with your cold compress of sympathy. Good night, brash world, with your electric glare. So Glotzstein throws the world back. All my redeemers, take your Jesus Marxes, choke on their daring, burst with each drop of our baptized blood. Cursing the miserable bargain the Jews made when they traded their Nigun, their hummed synagogue melodies, for Wagner's idle music, he turns his now straightened back. He turns his now back straightened, right, on all of Western civilization. Were he still in Europe, he would have had to keep his voice low, lest he invite collective punishment on all his fellow Jews. As an American, he had won the freedom to rage. And there was this advantage that he had the Yiddish language. So one could rage, and one was raging to a community within the larger context. But one did not have to worry about being overheard either. The publication of this poem set off an international debate from Buenos Aires through Paris to Warsaw. Some literal-minded Jews rejected the poem's call for a return to religion and tradition by someone who clearly had no intention of following his own advice, but others understood that Glotzstein's figurative summons back to Jewish life that he himself describes as verkoltnet, a term for hair that has been matted in sleep. This was mainly an indictment of a world so brutal the Jews would have to turn away from it, if only poetically. The poem's ending, the joy of homecoming weeps in me, captures the pain, the ironic, complex, twisted pain of Jews betrayed by an enlightenment that they had too enthusiastically embraced. Yet, this was still 1938. What followed would outstrip the Jewish imagination. Glotstein's father and the rest of his family were murdered. Nazi Germany wiped Jewish Poland off the map. What could the Jewish poet say that would be commensurate with the destruction? The biblical book of Lamentations had already been written, as many agonized over God's silence during the time of slaughter. And after it, Glotstein, assuming the dual office of defendant and prosecutor before the Almighty, spoke to the only presence that could fathom the enormity. Jews, after all, were his people. Like the psalmist, Glotstein addressed the Almighty in various moods. In one poem, the poet shows compassion for his Vogelbruder, his discredited fellow vagabond, fellow wanderer, against whose divine laws the merest child now mutinies. In another, God is an unhappy Maharal, the legendary creator of the golem whose wondrous conception has gone wrong. In a poem where Jews are going up in smoke through the crematoria, chimneys, horribly reminiscent of ancient sacrifice, the poet informs the Ancient of Days, wherever you may be, there all of us are also not. Paradox is the necessary condition of abandoned Jews who have stubbornly chosen to remain within the framework of the covenant. Now, this is not wit for its own sake, but testimony to the incongruity of Jewish survival. The more a Jew believes in divine guardianship, the more he must react to the unjust murder of the Jewish people. Glotstein warns the master of the universe, On Jeden wird nicht sein kein jüdischer Gott. Without Jews, there is no Jewish God. If Jews were to disappear from the earth, who else would remain to represent him? Abraham knew you in a cloud. Since then, you are the flame of our face, the rays our eyes blaze, our likeness whom we formed, in every land and town, a stranger. Turning biblical admonitions on their head, Glotstein threatens the Jewish God with his impending demise. According to the Kabbalah, the divine light that flowed into primordial space was intended to be held in special vessels. But under the impact of the light that emerged too suddenly, the vessels cracked. This is how the poem describes this. Shattered Jewish skulls, shards of the divine, smashed, shamed pots. These were your light-bearing vessels, your tangibles, your portents of miracle. Now count those heads by the millions of the dead. Around you, the stars go dark, our memory of you obscured. Soon your reign will close. The prophet Jeremiah famously said in God's name, My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and they have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water. But who had forsaken whom? Jewish heads, once aglow with the splendor of Jewish learning and Jewish belief, were now fragments of bone. Glotstein puts God on notice. Who will contain your light? Who will dream you, remember you, deny you, yearn after you? Who will flee you only to return over a bridge of longing? The importance of Jews in the cosmic order had subjected them to destruction on a cosmic scale. Nowhere but in liturgy was there a framework large enough to register their fate. Now, in the darkening years of the 20th century, the threatened end to civilization was by no means an exclusively Jewish subject. W.B. Yeats warned, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. T.S. Eliot warned, "This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper." W.H. Auden wrote of our world lying in stupor, beleaguered by negation and despair. Gluckstein knew their poetry very well, but he wrote in a language forged in intimate, familial relation to the eternal God. Take this poem, Genesis, which asks, why don't we start all over again, with a small people, out of the cradle and little? The two of us, he and God of the universe, the two of us, wanderers over the nations, tillers of the soil, will bow before you. You'll live on burnt offerings of grain. I'll go around preaching folk wisdom. It won't reach past our borders, but the least little child will greet me, good morning. Zionism, post-war reconstruction, Holocaust theology, the kibbutz movement, Jews seem to inhabit history with a capital H. Yiddish, the homey language, could indulge the idea of getting out of history's way. The poet chides himself for aspiring to fame and Almighty Yahweh for becoming God of the universe, as though the Jews had ever aspired to become the world's no-fail target, as though they now had control over their fate. You've deserted field and barn. I, the close love of my people, we've both turned universal. Come back, dear God, to a land no bigger than a speck. Dwindle down to only ours. I'll go around with homely sayings suitable for chewing over in small places. We'll both be provincial, God and his poet. Maybe it will go sweeter for us. Well, by 1948, the Jews had experienced in rapid succession both their greatest national defeat and a national resurrection such as no people had ever known. So now return to the Jewish people did not mean, as it had in 1938, back to the ghetto, but rather back to the homeland. This poem moves in the same direction as Goodnight World. And in both, the poet makes the switch from being acted upon to voluntary disengagement. Both admit the irony. Jews and their God have agency, if only their ambitions are modest enough. A poem resurrects the triad of God, his people, and the land of Israel. Now, the literary scholar Dan Miron reported hearing from Gluckstein shortly before the latter's death in 1971 that the destruction of Polish Jewry had made it impossible for him to finish the Yash trilogy. The return to America for the trilogy's final installment had been predicated on the continued responsibility for and connection to those still living in Europe. With them erased, Gluckstein saw how culturally impoverished American Jews had become. He found fault with himself and his cohort for having neglected to transmit Jewishness to their descendants in America. He judged this, which was then the world's largest Jewish community, unworthy of the civilization that we had inherited. He writes, "Like a small mousetrap, a shul stands in Long Island. The congregants are few. No one has yet discovered whether God ever drops in there for a while. The rabbi's piety is conservative. From his silent synagogue study, he sends God a letter at the old address. Come and hear my sermon about you on Sabbath. Don't forget." In his poems to God, the poet had spoken with passion. Some of your Jews still survive, but don't squander your legacy. In this diminished American Judaism, everything has been diminished. The ignorant congregants, the synagogue reduced to a mousetrap, and God summoned only as a courtesy. America has exchanged the awe of Sinai for the convenience of a drive-in. Gluckstein's caricatures of American Jewish life, and this is only one of them and not by any means the most searing, His caricatures belong with much post-war criticism of consumer society, with special emphasis on the commodification of religion. Now, all this time, Glotzstein did not neglect the literary community of which he was a part. He published reviews of new books, new interpretations of Jewish literature, reflections on world events. He tells us that one morning, he awoke before dawn in his New York bedroom with a rush of happiness such as he had not experienced since childhood. Trying to account for this burst of joy, he realizes that the date is November 29th, 1960, 13 years to the day since the United Nations voted for the partition of Palestine. He pities the poor, desiccated Jew who bites into such a day as into a dreary breakfast without realizing that something momentous has happened in Jewish life. Jews have yearned so long for miracles. He writes, how can we fail to see the bright hand of the miracle to which we have awakened? So Glotzstein traveled to Israel, where he was shown around Old Yaffa by Abraham Sutzkever, the Yiddish poet survivor of the Vilna Ghetto. He was welcomed by Israel's third president, whom, if you remember, is the Yiddish and Hebrew writer Zalman Shazar. And he had a book of poems published by the I.L. Peretz Press in Tel Aviv. His joy in Israel was truly childlike. One of his merriest poems describes being greeted upon his arrival in Israel by a bored immigration official who asks him, where are you from? Von Wannen. He replies, jeder Jids von Wannen is von Dannen. Every Jew's from where is from here. Or in Old English, it's better. Every Jew's whence is thence, right? It takes the officer a moment, but once he gets it, he calls over his fellow officers, and soon they are all dancing like Chabad Hasidim to the refrain, von Wannen, von Dannen. And once Jewish statehood has been normalized, it takes only a plain Yiddish rhyme to reanimate the miracle to which we have awakened. The language of European Jewry celebrates the Zionist reality. The richness of Glotzstein's writing at every stage makes me reluctant to sum him up. But his evolution from introspectivist to avowedly national poet is complicated by his own resistance to simplification. Glotzstein was not among the ideological Yiddishists who denounced the shift to Hebrew in Israel. But neither could he minimize what was being sacrificed. He could be harsher than Philip Roth in his caricature of Jewish suburbia, but while Roth leaves us with just a parody of hollowed out religion, Glotzstein includes the high standard from which it has fallen. He had the good fortune to attract as one of his translators the brilliant writer Cynthia Ozick, on some of whose translations I have relied here, including the one with which I will end, Yiddishkeit, Glotzstein's pitiless dissection of Jewish self-pity. Yiddish poets, why such yearning after what remembered burning of Sabbath candles turning to tapers round a beer? The slippage from a robust Jewish life into Yiddishkeit, nostalgia Jewishness, we can all too easily recognize in the American story, which now includes Holocaust nostalgia. Here, Glotzstein does not take the customary route of shaming the nouveau riche, and instead he goes after his own kind, the Yiddish poets who are stuck yearning for a lost past, and he warns them, himself included, longings, a crooning, for old men gumming sops. Was it we were doomed to dole these bits of soggy bread, hollow words and dead? We, who once went mooning, but now the dream's undone, for a great assembly of our own? The allusion here is to the Ethics of the Fathers, the best known part of the Talmud, which opens with the chain of transmission. Moses received the Torah from Sinai, and handed it on to Joshua. and Joshua to the elders, and the elders to the prophets, and the prophets to the men of the great assembly. They said three things: be deliberate in judgment, raise many disciples, and make a hedge around the Torah. That was their legacy. Well, what was going to be ours? Having placed himself and modern Yiddish poetry in this continuum, Glotzstein concludes that separately and together, they had failed at the key enterprise of transmission. But he had not been one of those toothless necromancers. He left us a legacy more important today than when it was written. His warnings are our encouragement. His struggles inspire our responsibilities. One of his poetry books was actually called Die Freude von Jiddischen Wort, the joy of the Jewish word, which is also the Yiddish word, because in Yiddish, the words Yiddish and Jewish are one and the same. So you actually can never say Yiddish without at the same time saying Jewish. So Die Freude, the joy of the Yiddish word, is also the joy of the Jewish word. He leaves us with this paradox that his hard realism and foreboding bring us discovery and delight. And it's my pleasure to share some of this with you. Thank you.